Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly show about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm joined today by John Wells, who's sitting in for Tim Henney. Well, he's on assignment in search, I suppose, of health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyles. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Lynn.
Today, we'll speak first with Joy McCarthy. She'll bring a wealth of knowledge about simple, clean, and whole health. We make it so complicated, but you'll love hearing from Joy.
And then we will speak with Krista Bremer. She's a free-spirited blonde surfer girl, to someone who never imagined she'd find herself in what she calls an accidental jihad. Bremer will be taking us through the joys, triumphs, challenges of marrying a Muslim and all that goes along with it.
This is The Mountain Life. Healthy living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Hi, this is Kevin Stocking, president of Heber Valley Bank in Heber City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team is focused on building long-term relationships through satisfying your deposit and lending needs. We have 2 branches in Heber and Midway. 1 branch in Park City, Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power WattSmart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, WattSmart.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, joined by John Wells, sitting in for Tim Henney today. Well, if we just followed the basics of health, the wholesome ideas, not straying to embrace trends and then fall off the wagon, if we just use most things in moderation and to know what is true in nutrition and be able to distinguish those false prophets coming up with the latest trend, we'd be a whole world ahead, wouldn't we? Well, if we had improved digestion, increased energy, great sleep, balanced hormones, do any of those sound good to you? And could you just achieve them by following some good, solid practices? Well, our first guest is joining us to talk about some of these practices and good whole food. Well, simple food. Joy McCarthy is our guest. She's an international speaker and is the co-founder of Eat Well, Feel Well. It's an integrated nutrition program in Canada. She regularly contributes her health expertise to many Canadian TV programs and different publications, but she's dipping down into these lower latitudes today to shine some light on her neighbors. Joy McCarthy, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I guess I want to start with this question. You know, in America, we are what we are. We have all these cultural things that contribute to our nutrition. We are prone to wanting to achieve today what we want to achieve. And we hear a lot about how they do it in Europe. It's always about, oh, in Europe, they eat whole food. In Europe, they automatically eat in moderation. And I'm wondering, we don't hear a lot about Canada. So, you know, what's your take on what you do up there versus what we do?
I would like to say that I follow those habits as well that a lot of Europeans do. I can't speak for every Canadian, but I can definitely speak for myself and my family and a lot of the clients that I consult. So this is what I teach. You know, it's not just about what you eat, but it's also about enjoying what you're eating and enjoying life as well. And, you know, a healthy life lifestyle plays such a profound role in our overall health and well-being. And that's why, you know, I'm so glad that you brought that up. You know, I love traveling to Europe, and I love the fact that people don't rush through their meal. And, you know, you don't see people sitting, you know, if people go to a restaurant, and it's a whole social experience. I think in North America, I think in Canada, it's very similar to the U.S. A lot of people, they sit in front of their TV or they sit in front of their computer while they're working, eating, not eating very mindfully. And this is terrible for example, for your digestive system. You're not going to properly digest your food when you're not actually focused on eating it and in a joyful state. So this is one thing I really try and teach people is to eat mindfully. You know, we eat away from distraction. And that can be a bit overwhelming for people. So, you know, this is like one simple habit you could try. Just commit, you know, for the next 7 days that at least two meals that you eat away from distraction and you really eat with full awareness. And you'll be amazed at how much better your food tastes and how much better your food choices are when you eat with more awareness.
Mm. And maybe you can clarify for me. I always forget. I've heard this explanation many times over about the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems, but I always forget which one's which and which one engages when we, you know, when we're stressed, when we're eating, or when we're not calm and relaxed.
Exactly. So most people live their lives in sympathetic nervous system mode, and that's the fight or flight response, basically. So the stress response. Whereas in order to properly digest your food, in order to have a good night's sleep, your nervous system needs to be in parasympathetic nervous system mode. It's basically called the rest and digest mode. And so what you can do, you know, because most people live in sympathetic nervous system mode, there's simple habits that I talk about in my book. For example, just taking 10 deep diaphragmic breaths, so meaning breathing from your belly, 10 deep diaphragmic breaths can calm your central nervous system in a snap. So, you know, if you find that you've been running around all morning, it's time for lunch, and you're going to be standing eating your lunch, you should force yourself to sit down, take 10 deep breaths, and you'll be so much calmer. And if we look at children, kids know how to breathe. Like, if you have kids, you know, look at your 10-year-old. You look at your child the next time you see them breathing. If they're taking a nap, they breathe from their belly. As adults, we totally forget how to breathe. We breathe very shallow. And this is a stress on the body because we really need to breathe deeply so that we can oxygenate our whole body. We can think more clear. We get more oxygen and nourishment to the brain. And it helps us to be calmer and happier people.
We are breathing hard here in the studio right now.
And deep from our bellies.
I wanted to mention I had heard a couple of months ago about every morning, starting your morning, not with coffee, but with lemon and water. Water at either room temperature or slightly warm. And I read that in your book as well. Why don't you tell us about the advantages of that? I've been doing this now for, I think, about a month, and I like it. It's a great way to start the morning.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked me about this because this is one of my favorite things to talk about is the simple habit of drinking freshly squeezed lemon in a large glass of water first thing in the morning on an empty stomach. So lemon is a natural cleanser. Nature has provided us with this amazing food that has cleansing properties because it stimulates your liver's detoxifying enzymes. And, you know, when we think of lemon, we often think of cleaners because they're often in things like household cleaners. And so the other thing that lemons do is they really help our digestive system and they help to alkalinize our body. Even though, you know, when we think of a lemon, as being acidic, right? But it actually has an alkaline effect on the body. And this is a simple habit that anyone can do. So I'm glad you asked me because, you know, if there's nothing else that people take away from my book, I hope that they do this simple habit of lemon and water every day. Room temperature water is always best as well. But I'm so glad to hear that you are doing it and you've been doing it for a full month. So now it's a habit. That's great.
It is a habit. And I wait about a half an hour before I have a single cup of coffee. Is that okay?
Perfect. Yes. That's so great that you do that. That's really fantastic.
Just one other thing. It seems to me that the therapeutic value as you look at your 10 points back to drinking lemon and water, that it increases bile the stimulation of the liver's secretion of bile, which of course is really good. Can you talk about that? Because that's pretty important.
Yeah, totally. So bile, along with fiber, is a carrier of toxins, and bile helps to break down fat as well. So when you're having the lemon water, this is yet another reason that it helps you better detoxify, because it stimulates bile, and we need bile, because bile, you know, without being gross, sorry, that's actually what turns our stools that chestnut brown color. So we know we have a well-functioning liver, a well-functioning gallbladder when we're producing bile, because we can tell by the color of our stools, and lemon will help you do that. So, you know, one of the most common things I hear people tell me when they do lemon and water is that it enhances their digestive system. They have better elimination. It helps with things even like heartburn, even though that seems counterintuitive. Lemon really helps to strengthen the digestive system. And oftentimes, more often than not, people suffer from heartburn because of weak digestion. And so lemon helps to strengthen it and helps to move food through better.
Mm. Well, it's good to introduce this whole topic of alkaline versus acidic. And I do want to ask you about stomach acids, because apparently we are very confused about it, because we're fed a diet, or maybe we're marketed to, about things like Tums. They reduce stomach acids, but we actually need more stomach acids. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So here's the thing. You know, when you eat something like a burger and fries and then you follow up with a milkshake, all those sugars are going to ferment. And that whole fermentation creates gaseous byproducts that push up through the esophagus and give us pain. And so then we take a Tums just to suppress that pain. Or we take a pharmaceutical drug every day to lower stomach acids so we don't produce any acids. But what we're actually doing is we are impairing our digestion even further when we take acid-suppressing drugs or pop Tums. That actually makes the problem worse. So you have to address the root cause. You don't have low stomach acid because stomach acid is imperative for breaking down protein. And protein, when broken down into smaller parts, becomes amino acids. And amino acids are building blocks of neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine. So stomach acid is absolutely critical for digestion, and it's critical for your health. And I would say the large majority, I'd say over 90% of my clients that I see in my practice who come to me with heartburn don't actually have excess stomach acid production. They have low stomach acid. They have a poor diet. And just, you know, changing what they're eating, making a few modifications, get them doing lemon and water, can completely eliminate heartburn.
So that's interesting. Then if we are those who eat Tums all day because of our heartburn, are we actually, you know, obviously we're just treating a symptom, not a cause, but are we also then inhibiting the further breakdown of proteins because we're eliminating acids? Or do Tums do something, or antacids in general, do something else?
Yeah, we're weakening our digestion. You know, when I was a teen, I actually, oh my gosh, the other brand, Rolaids, I used to take like 2 to 3 Rolaids a day. I had such horrible digestion. I had no idea what the root cause, what was going on. And, you know, I was able to get off of those and completely transform my health. And I was someone who used to take those every single day, and it just made my digestion worse. It wasn't until I got off of them, addressed my diet, and ate better foods, and also practiced, I don't know if you've heard of food combining, but food combining. So in my book, in the digestive chapter, I talk about some of the most common digestive problems, one of them being heartburn. And so food combining can really help eliminate things like heartburn. So, you know, just a simple tip is when you're next time you're eating, really try and eat lightest to heaviest. So for example, if you're eating fish with some vegetables, eat your veggies first and then eat your fish, the protein and fat, because protein and fat can take 3 to 4 to 5 hours to leave the stomach for digestion. But the carbs, being the vegetables, digest further along, mainly in the small intestine. So if you eat lightest to heaviest, especially with people who have weak digestion, it really helps to improve your digestive system and reduce symptoms like bloating and gas and heartburn.
Joy, my grandfather once told me, I can't believe I'm quoting my grandfather. He told me a lot of things. This may be the only thing that I can share on public radio. But my grandfather once told me, eat breakfast like a king. Eat lunch like a prince. Eat dinner like a pauper. Is that good advice?
I love that. It's very good advice. Most people eat their largest meal, as you know, at night. And at night, this is when you want your body wants to be in rest and digest mode. And when you eat your largest meal, say you eat at 9 o'clock, a lot of people eat quite late, and then you go to bed, you know, an hour or two later. This is not great for your metabolism, for example. Your body doesn't want to be digesting food when it should be preparing for sleep. So the other thing is, a lot of times you'll store more fat if you're eating later at night. So yes, eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, dinner like a pauper is such great advice, because you burn calories all throughout the day, and you need that energy first thing in the morning. So I think that's great advice your grandfather gave you.
It's a tough one, though. Being Irish American, we used to have these huge plates that my mother would prepare for dinner, and it's kind of hard to get out of that habit, but I guess you just have to do something for, I don't know, a couple of months, and you might be able to get these new habits.
Well, you know, the other thing is, if you eat a little bit less at night, you're going to be hungrier in the morning. I hear a lot of people tell me they just have no appetite in the morning, but that's because they're eating too late, and the food hasn't left the gut. So they still have their dinner from last night in their stomach, you know, it's still digesting. So the other thing is, you know, a lot of people think that, oh, I have to completely change what I'm eating then if I'm going to eat breakfast like a king. Not necessarily. You can eat the same kind of breakfast foods. It just means that, you know, at night, in the evening, you just eat a little bit less. And you will find if you eat a bigger breakfast, you generally speaking eat less calories throughout the entire day. And this really helps to fire up your metabolism, helps to balance your blood sugar, so keep insulin levels in check, because breakfast skippers tend to have higher levels of insulin, and insulin is our fat storage hormone. We want to keep insulin levels in check as well, because they increase inflammation, and inflammation is what leads to cancer and heart disease. So eating a really good quality breakfast is taking great steps to joyous health.
And Joy, I believe you also say that you should always couple protein with every one of those meals.
Yes, I always recommend eating some sort of protein, because protein is thermogenic, meaning it stimulates metabolism, and it also keeps you satiated. So often when I look at people's food journals and they tell me that they constantly have cravings, all they're eating are carbs. It's not that carbs are a bad thing, because you should eat complex carbs as well because of the primary source of fuel for your brain, but you want to make sure that you combine it with a protein and a fat too. But protein is so important, and it takes longer to digest, so you feel fuller longer as well.
You know, going back to the food combining thing and with, you know, eating the carbohydrates first, I've always wondered, and again, this goes back to why they do it so well in Europe and we don't here. But, you know, in Europe, you eat fruit last, right? And, you know, and dessert is always known to be eaten last, although some of us eat it first. You know, but what is the reason behind then? If they do it so well in Europe, why do they eat fruit last then? Because that it'll just ferment on top of the heavier food.
Well, I think the other thing is, you know, why people tend to be so much healthier in Europe is really lifestyle. You know, they live differently. Not all the big cities now, because they're kind of following after North America. But you go to the smaller towns in Europe, and they just have a more relaxed lifestyle. And
right.
I think that plays a massive role in digestion. So and the other thing is, they don't overeat. So, you know, if they are having a main meal like dinner, they're not stuffing themselves so full that their digestion is so weak when they then go and eat dessert. But what I would recommend, you know, I'm not anti-dessert. I have lots of dessert recipes in my book. But if you do have weak digestion, you do want to avoid eating fruits and dessert right after a main meal. You know, if you do want it, wait at least 2 hours and then have it. And you'll notice a really big difference in your digestion. Then you will also be eating that dessert with more mindful awareness. And you're not just going to be eating it to be in a food coma, right? Mm-hmm. You'll be more aware of it, and you enjoy it so much more when you say, you know, I'm going to wait a little bit. I don't need this dessert right away. I'm going to wait a couple of hours, and if I still want it, I will have it.
Right. Well, you seem to be quite the expert on our digestion in general. And I want to tell you, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the author Mary Roach, but she wrote a book. She's American, and she wrote a book called Gulp. We interviewed her, and it was called Adventures Along the Alimentary Canal. And she gets into the down and dirty nitty-gritty of flatulence. And we were so interested talking to her that we actually skipped this entire chapter, which we were really bummed about later. But
I think there were three chapters on flatulence.
Oh, right.
Right.
I mean, it just went on and on. But, you know, so maybe we should ask you a little bit more about that because, you know, it's a topic we don't like to talk about. I mean, there are the fart jokes and that sort of thing. But, you know, what can we do to avoid that altogether?
Yeah, so there's a few different things. First of all, let's start simple. One of the simplest ways to have better digestion and prevent things like flatulence is to simply chew your food more. Most people chew their food maybe 5 times, and so you're swallowing large particles of food. And this really weakens your digestive system. It can cause gas and bloating because here's the thing, your stomach doesn't have teeth. Your mouth is for mechanical digestion, so digestion starts in the mouth. The other thing is that your saliva produces enzymes that help to break down your food. So a simple habit is to chew your food until a paste, and that will strengthen your digestive system, and then you're less likely to have problems like flatulence. The other thing are food sensitivities. A lot of people are sensitive to gluten. They're sensitive to dairy. Pretty much everyone is sensitive to refined sugars. And these weaken our digestion. And so sugar is a primary cause of flatulence because it causes, it ferments, it starts to digest by fermenting, which causes more gas and causes things like flatulence. So, you know, being cautious, be aware by doing a food journal of the foods that you're eating all the time. And foods that most people eat are things like pastas and breads and cereals and far too much dairy, and then we end up becoming intolerant to these foods, and it can cause things like flatulence.
Mm, it's so funny. This reminds me of a college friend I had who you know, did his own personal food journal, but it was all about GORP, you know, good old raisins and peanuts. So he calculated that a handful of raisins and peanuts would produce exactly however many it was, you know, farts.
That's nice, Lynn.
Yeah, I don't know why. I just remembered that.
Yeah. Joy, we all do the best we can to get our daily fiber, but we typically fall short, or most people fall short. What is your opinion of taking ground psyllium husks with water to sort of augment that?
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Because that acts like a sponge. It's very detoxifying. So when that fiber travels through the digestive system, it really absorbs toxins and helps to eliminate them. You just have to be careful, though, because you really have to make sure you drink a lot of water. Otherwise, that fiber can act like cement in your colon and can actually have the reverse effect that you want it to have. It can actually make you constipated. So as with anything, when you're increasing fiber in your diet, if you right now eat the standard American diet, which is full of processed foods, if you start out slowly introducing these things, start out slowly introducing fiber so it doesn't backfire. And the other thing is that fiber, it like really helps to tone the gut. You know, your gut is muscle, and so that's why you want to increase fiber slowly if you're not currently eating any fiber. And, you know, fibers that are very easy to digest are fibers that you just get from fruits and vegetables. So that's a good place to start as well. So psyllium is great. Also chia seeds. Chia seeds are a fantastic source of fiber. And, you know, doing, for example, I have a recipe for strawberry chia pudding. So making that pudding, you could have that, you know, as a mid-afternoon power snack full of protein and good fat and fiber, or have it as, you know, that could be your dessert after dinner. And that's going to help you have good bowel movements too.
Our guest is Joy McCarthy. She's the author of Joyous Health, Eat and Live Well Without Dieting. She has over 150 recipes and tips in addition to all this good advice.
And it is good advice. Joy, Are there any new strategies being studied that show promise on this country's war on obesity?
Yes. Yeah, there's lots of fascinating research happening. I'm really interested in the research on probiotics. and how bacteria impacts our mood. Our gut health has a huge effect on our mental health and well-being. There's a lot of interesting research that's ongoing on the power of probiotics. So I recommend to eat fermented foods every single day, you know, whether that be sauerkraut, kefir, kombucha, kimchi. These are all foods that are fermented. You can find them at most grocery stores, at all health food stores. I mean, you can make sauerkraut yourself, but these are truly probiotic-rich foods. And so good bacteria actually helps to transmit messages via the vagus nerve to your brain. So your gut is your second brain.
So, you know, we all know people who eat a ton, but they stay really thin. They just don't have a problem with weight. How much of that is metabolism? How much of that is their particular probiotic mix?
Yeah, so I think it can be a combination of both, but it's mostly metabolism. A lot of people, so I see a lot of people like that in my clinic, and oftentimes they have a hyperthyroid. But here's the thing, you know, oftentimes we associate, we just assume that thinness or slimness equates to health. But I see a lot of these people who don't need to lose weight, but they have low energy. They can't sleep. They have acne. They have eczema. They suffer from anxiety and depression. And it goes back to what they're eating. They're just not eating the raw materials for a good mood. They're not eating the raw materials for great skin, great hair, great health. And so, you know, that's the result of a poor diet. So some people just, you know, they have a super fast metabolism. They don't keep weight on, but if they're eating crappy, then they feel crappy.
Mm. Well, Joy, we're going to let you go in a minute here, but thank you so much for joining us. Joy McCarthy's book is Joyous Health, Eat and Live Well Without Dieting. And, you know, it's hard to describe a book like yours on the airwaves because I'm holding it in my hand, but our listeners are not. So you integrate all of these wonderful practices and knowledge about nutrition and health into in and amongst your recipes. And then talk about how your recipes are coded.
Yeah, so I have a little legend for each recipe. So a lot of people now can't eat dairy because they have food intolerances. They can't eat gluten. So you can find recipes that are dairy-free. You can find recipes that are raw, and they're indicated by that. Also, there's a little J that indicates a comfort food, so joyous comfort food. Mm-hmm. And so it's a fun way to identify delicious recipes. But really, my book is a celebration of eating delicious and nourishing food. You know, it's a great benefit that all the recipes are super nourishing, but, you know, they taste amazing. So that's the feedback, because my book has been out in Canada since January, and people have been making recipes from my blog for years. And the feedback I always get is, I can't believe how easy it is to be healthy with your recipes because they taste so good.
Mm, and that's really the key, isn't it, to making it simple and giving ourselves no excuse to not do it. So, Joy McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us. And where can we find your blog?
My blog is Joyous Health, so joyoushealth.com.
Very good. Joy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Thank you.
And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back. We'll be speaking with Krista Bremmer. She's the author of The Accidental Jihad. And wow, what a beautiful and interesting book about love, discovery, challenging your own thoughts about your own culture, religion, and customs. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Eric Karshner, Assistant General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club and sponsor of The Mountain Life on KPCW. Park Meadows Country Club is Park City's in-town private country club, just minutes from historic Main Street. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Experience the ride of a lifetime on the Comet Bobsled Ride and Rocket Skeleton Ride at the Utah Olympic Park. Take a thrilling ride down the entire length of the 2002 Olympic track, ripping through 15 turns and reaching speeds up to 80 miles per hour on the Winter Comet bobsled ride. The Rocket Skeleton Ride offers the solo adventure of shooting headfirst down the last five turns of the track. Reservations required. Details and restrictions are available online at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
And welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm John Wells. I'm sitting in for Tim Henney. I'm also here with Lynn Ware Peak, my co-host. Our next guest, Krista Brenner, chose the title for her new book, My Accidental Jihad, because that's exactly what it was, accidental. The blonde surfer girl with few concerns in her life never imagined she'd meet and fall in love with a Muslim man from an impoverished village in Libya. But she did. And she married him. And her story is one of finding herself, finding that we all marry someone whose cultural and personal differences from ours will send us into examination of our own. Bremer is the publisher of The Sun and the recipient of the Rona Jaffe Foundation Award. Her essays have been widely published, and she's been featured on NPR and PBS series of Arab American Stories. She's joining us by phone. Krista Brenner, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, Krista, you are a Protestant light and you marry a staunch Catholic, huh?
Well, I think it is absolutely true that every marriage is bicultural. And it seems to me that whether we marry someone from the other side of the world, as I've done, or we marry someone from our very same hometown, we still arrive into marriage with radically different notions about home and family and love and what those should look like. And we have to negotiate these differences. And we also arrive at the place where the mate that we've chosen suddenly seems impossibly foreign. And I'm really interested in what we do in those moments. And that has been the impetus for my writing. So I'm interested in exploring what intimacy entails and what enduring love actually requires of us, and also what gifts it offers us in return for the hard work.
Well, I really enjoyed your writing and the book. It was really an eye-opener. And I wanted to mention, when you first met Ismail, did I pronounce his name correctly?
Yes, that's fine.
When you first met him, before you started dating him, you were running together in the woods of North Carolina. And I believe you said at some point that you missed the ocean, being from California. And he said he missed the ocean as well. Your view of the ocean, of course, is, you know, wading into the Pacific on a beautiful morning, paddling to the endless horizon, as you write. And he tells a completely different story about spearfishing along a reef for hours in a blistering summer day. He could only return home after he caught enough food to feed his entire family. I think there were 13 siblings, only 8 survived, so that's a lot of fish. And then he talks about his village on the water, where a closet-like library where 4 boys crowd around the same book waiting to patiently turn the page until the other one had read the previous page. And then the wild dog story, where his father was attacked by wild dogs and his father had to kill the lead dog to be able to get out of there. So when you talk about missing the ocean, both of you, I mean, it's totally different environments.
I think that's such a great example of what I explore in this book, because you're right. On one hand, we're talking about very different experiences of the ocean, but on the other hand, this longing that we both felt towards something that we loved, that we related to our childhood, was universal. So it was different, and it was also the same.
Mm. That's nice. You know, Krista, I'm wondering about your title. It's such a perfect title, My Accidental Jihad. And I always like to hear different definitions of the word jihad. What is yours?
Well, thank you for asking that, because I always think it's a good starting point, because I know that many Americans associate the word jihad with horrific acts of violence. And I also know that in Arabic, the word simply means struggle. And I know through my Muslim husband that the Prophet Muhammad taught that the greatest struggle or jihad of our entire lives is the one that takes place in our hearts. It's the struggle against our egos. It's the struggle against our selfishness and intolerance and impatience and this effort to try to pry our hearts open just a little more every single day for the sake of our families and our communities and for humanity in general. And I could think of no better way to describe my experience of marriage because I find marriage challenging. And I also find that there's no better vehicle for my spiritual growth and my personal growth because marriage is the place where I have to confront these aspects of myself that I'd really prefer to avoid.
Boy, that is so fascinating. Go ahead.
Yeah, and just that, you know, these aspects of myself that I am actually able to keep fairly well hidden from many people in my life on a daily basis, but that really come to the fore in marriage.
You know, I'm wondering, Krista, if you, you know, when you met Ishmael, you know, as a Muslim, you knew that he had so many cultural and religious differences than you did. And yet there was this fairy tale kind of falling in love that we all sort of dream about. However, many of us, I think, would go headlong into it, thinking that our soulmate, you know, is there and everything's going to be perfect. And we would completely ignore the signs of these huge gaps in our or huge differences. But you, faced with this accidental falling in love with this Muslim whose background was so different from yours, you talk about feeling joy and terror at the same time. Did it protect you somehow?
Oh, I don't know. I would say that I recall those early times of my relationship as a period of such intense ambivalence. It was really confusing for me because on one hand, I was with this man who made me feel more at home and at ease than I had ever felt in someone's company, and that was wonderful. And on the other hand, this guy was older and darker and poorer and more foreign than the husband I had always imagined for myself. And so I recall swinging between joy and terror on a regular basis because I really couldn't imagine how this would work, and yet it was proceeding forward at a pretty steady pace. So it was a confusing time. And I think in many ways I wrote this book to claim that experience as a love story because I found myself in a position where I was having an intimate relationship that was quite enriching and gratifying, and yet it looked nothing like I thought love was supposed to look like. And I realized that my whole life I had been collecting notions about romance and love from things like songs and movies and advertisements. And I realized that some of the stories that I held on to about love were causing me suffering because my life did not match the story. And so I wrote this book as a way to claim a different type of experience.
Boy, that's fascinating. Or how many times and what were the instances in which you said, this is just too different, the chasm between our religious and our cultural existences, it's just too much?
Well, I'd have to take, we've been together 15 years and multiply that by the number of days. I mean, I think what you describe is my state of mind when we're having a difficult argument. And there is always that moment of wanting to flee, of wanting to throw in the towel. But I find that is an emotional state that's just as fleeting as all of our emotions. You know, so, I mean, I think in a way you're describing the same moment I was talking about, that moment when our partner seems so foreign and perhaps even seems like our enemy. And and I think in those moments, we can see the seeds of war in our own hearts. Because, you know, there's this impulse to just reject, that person's humanity, you know, to close down the heart and to just walk away or erase that person. And, you know, I think that's universal, but thank God it's also passing.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Krista Bremer. Her book is My Accidental Jihad, A Love Story.
Krista, I have to believe that some of your readers will go through this book. It's very well written. It's very honest. And they will think about their own situation. They will think about, and maybe they're not in love, and maybe they're not married, but they want to be married, and they have thoughts of marrying in a certain social circle, a spouse that makes so much money, you know, the sorts of things that, you know, that you questioned as well. But in reading your book, you know, it may open them up to other types of love. No, not other types of love, but something completely different than they had envisioned. Have you heard from readers that may have told that story?
Oh, I absolutely have. If anything, it has my work in the last few months, going around the country and talking to people about this book, has really made me more convinced than ever that while the differences in my marriage are unique, the work itself is the same. And what surprises me is to sometimes hear from readers who want to talk to me about intimacy, but not intimacy in marriage. And it makes me realize that this kind of work that we do in intimacy, it relates to all kinds of relationships. It relates to parents and children. It relates to neighbors. You know, it relates in many different ways. So I just received a note not long ago from a young man in Australia who had made the decision that he wanted to become a priest. And his parents were so upset by that choice that they were attacking both his sanity and his sexuality. And he wrote to tell me that it was so painful for him to encounter such intolerance in his own family, and that he was so moved by the tolerance that he found in my book. And you know, by the work that I did, not just to understand my husband, but also my children. There's places in the book where I'm trying to navigate some difficult parenting situations. So hearing from people like that is really gratifying to me, and it also makes me reflect on how home is a complicated notion. It can be the place where we feel most at ease, and it can also be the place where we feel most foreign.
And what did this gentleman believe he was going to do about all of this once he read the book and once he sent you the note that he sent you? Was he encouraged to follow his heart? Was he going to give copies of the book to his family? How was he going to work through the situation?
Oh, unfortunately, I wish that my writing could give him an easy answer, but I don't think it could. However, I think what it did is it affirmed for him that those types of human connections that are filled with tolerance and understanding are in fact possible. And I think it made him even more painfully aware of the shortcomings he found in his relationship with his parents. But hopefully it also convinced him that this work, you know, that this struggle is worthwhile, and if we persist, we sometimes can have a profound impact on those relationships.
The question of tolerance and understanding, Krista, is something that I keep thinking about during this conversation. And I'm wondering, you know, we have tolerance and understanding for a variety of reasons, but I'm wondering how much you, for example, would cut your husband a break because, for, you know, he grew up in a mud hut, say, versus, you know, him trying to cut him a break because, or not cutting him a break because he's being a jerk. You know, like you have more justification, I would say, to cut him a break, right?
Well, I think you're pointing towards something that occupies me a lot when I write, And that is that I feel that if I write about someone else, then I have a serious responsibility to them, because there's quite a power imbalance there. So if I'm the one who gets to tell the story, and if my husband is gracious enough to support this work, which really exposes him tremendously in the world, then I feel a cardinal rule of my writing must be to be harder on myself than to anyone else who appears in the book. So I think that that's obvious throughout the book, that I continually take myself to account, and I'm willing to reveal even painfully honest shortcomings that I have. But I would not do that casually to anyone that I love, because I don't think that it's fair to them. So I think as the writer of the book, I have to walk a fine balance between being as honest as I can about who we are and also being mindful of the position that I'm in as the author and the obligation that I have to any of the characters that appear in the story.
What a great self-discovery.
Krista, you write in your book that your first trip to Libya was like stepping into a ransacked home of the abuser, where suffering was on the face of everyone you saw. Can you take a minute and describe Gaddafi's Libya?
Oh, my goodness. Gaddafi's Libya was a terrifying place. And when I embarked on that journey, I thought that I was prepared because I had traveled to Europe and to India and Mexico, and I imagined I knew something about travel, but nothing could have prepared me for that place. And the best way that I can describe it to you is that when I stepped off the plane, it was as if the entire country sat under the weight of extreme depression. And the depression was tangible. It literally felt like a weight bearing down on you the moment you stepped onto Libyan soil. And that feeling did not leave me until the moment our plane lifted off, and the relief that I felt the moment that the plane lifted off from Libyan soil was really sort of mind-blowing. And I've spoken to Libyans who shared that same experience. That seems to be somewhat universal. It was just such an oppressive place, and yet there was this stark contrast between that oppression on the streets and the warmth in the homes that I visited. And it was really quite extraordinary and moving to me that my Libyan relatives, in spite of everything that they had endured, were able to maintain some joy in their homes and warmth and the most gracious hospitality I honestly had ever encountered. So it was almost like a schizophrenic way of being. On one hand, stepping out onto the streets into a darkness unlike any I've ever imagined, and then on the other hand, in the homes, a kind of warmth and welcoming that I also had never imagined.
That joy and the warmth in homes, you think of it as sort of a solidarity that rises out of that oppression and the heavy weight. I'm wondering how those two those two contrasting emotions surface in Ishmael.
Oh, that's quite insightful, actually, because I think that they both are there. I think one aspect of my husband's culture that I absolutely love is the fact that it is so community-driven. The fact there is a warmth to that culture and a sense of belonging to one another that is really beautiful to me, coming from this more American perspective that is far more individualistic. And so that I really appreciate in him. And I think it's true that Gaddafi did something so horrific to the Libyan people over 40 years that there is serious trauma among Libyans. And I imagine that it could take generations for that to be resolved for them. I think that the sense of oppression, you know, like, for example, in my husband's family, his father owned a small shop And one day, Gaddafi arbitrarily took ownership of that shop. And if you can imagine what that did to a man who was trying to support a family of 10 and suddenly found himself unable to support any of them, it's as if Gaddafi emasculated an entire country of men by denying them their right to just provide for their families. So I think my husband suffers for, you know, for example, the way his father became a violent and depressed man. And so the oppression that his father experienced, he then brought into the home and visited upon his wife and his children.
Wow. Oh, goodness. It's really just so interesting, and you do such a wonderful job of bringing it to your reading audience, and it's probably has something to do with your involvement with this wonderful magazine, The Sun, over so many years. And can you just give us a really quick synopsis of your time there?
Oh, yeah. I have been working at The Sun magazine for over 10 years, and it is a magazine that I absolutely loved before I began to work there. And it is known for its beautiful personal writing and its outstanding fiction and poetry and photography. And it's a magazine that has a conscience that's unlike any other magazine I've known. And in many ways, my admiration for the magazine has really shaped my own creative work, because the magazine holds a high standard in terms of what it expects authors to do on the page. It's not enough to be glib. It's not enough to simply be entertaining. The author needs to strive to get as close as possible to the truth. And so I think it's taught me to hold those kind of standards for myself when I sit down at my desk.
Krista, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. We both really enjoyed this conversation. And best of luck with your book.
Well, I did too. Thank you for having me.
Krista Bremer, My Accidental Jihad, A Love Story. And we'll be returning after these messages, but let me just quickly thank our underwriters, Park City Clinic, Prudential Utah Real Estate, Stein Erickson Lodge, and Park Meadows Country Club.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service, Park City's Local Tree Care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Weir Peake, and thanks to you, John Wells, for sitting in today.
It's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed this morning's show.
Oh, absolutely. Two wonderful guests. I want to thank again Joy McCarthy of Joyous Health and Krista Bremer, who we just got off the phone with, My Accidental Jihad, A Love Story. Also want to thank Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, and Park Meadows Country Club. And tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. John and I will be here again for
Cool Science Radio.
There we go. And we'll be speaking with at least one of our guests is a geologist from the Utah Geological Survey, talking about potential landslides, especially in the Rockville area near Zion. There was the horrific rock slide back in December that killed two people. He'll be talking about that and all kinds of geology going on in our state. There's a lot of interesting geology here. I didn't need to tell you that.
A lot going on.
That's right. And you can always access archived programs of The Mountain Life or Cool Science Radio. Go to kpcw.org and go click on the shows tab, and you'll find all the archived shows.